LGIM Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Many investors combine concerns over overcrowding and factors with capacity fears. Here to help separate these terms and help provide some clarity on the state of factors is Dave Barron, Head of Index Equity and Factor-Based Investing at LGIM. Dave, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
Talk to us about the title, overcrowding capacity. Is there a distinction between these terms?
Yeah, I think in financial markets, we're always, many of us are guilty of kind of taking some good academic thought that has a lot of rigor behind a definition and kind of twisting that or making some assumptions. So specific to overcrowding, you know, the definition is more along the lines of something that people feel rather than an actual fact. So, you know, looking at Oxford, it's the presence of more people or things in a space that feels comfortable or safe, whereas capacity is the maximum amount that something can contain. And that's a key distinction because it really is about the eye of the beholder when it comes to deciding when something's overcrowded.
So when to take this to factors, we're talking about the kind of the six more traditional factors that people know. It's kind of value, growth, momentum, dividend, low volatility, those kind of ones.
Yes, exactly. So specific to finance, you know, you're looking at when am I comfortable in investing in one of these factors. So factors are supposed to produce superior risk-adjusted returns because they've got this long-standing risk premium embedded in them, and clients and investors want to allocate to them. But the question is, if they're over-allocated at some point, is that return gonna be realized? You know, the same way in sample versus, you know, what it's looked like in the academic, you know, history from an analysis standpoint. So absolutely, it comes down to really, you know, evaluating what those factors are doing today. Are they performing the way they're supposed to be performing? Are they doing what they should in different market environments? And that's something that we can look at to garner if something might be on the verge of let's say, overcrowded.
So I think to describe this in your article, you have this kind of wonderfully colorful metaphor about a cafe. I mean, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the way I think about it is, you know, again, back to the eye of the beholder, or it's up to the person who's kind of making the decision from an investment standpoint is what are you comfortable with? So when I go, you know, personally approach a cafe and I see three people there, that becomes overcrowded for me. I'm kind of a, you know,
bit claustrophobic.
Exactly. I'm not waiting in that line. Yeah. There's probably another cafe down the street. You know, there's probably another factor that I can allocate to if I get a little fearful of what the current landscape looks like. There's some people who love a crowded cafe who want to be involved in that kind of an environment, and they think, look, there's lots of room here. I know there's more people behind me, and translate that into investment parlance. You're looking at, okay, I'm in this factor. It's good for me if more people are buying this factor because all else equal, you know, the price or the value of that factor is going to go up. So I'm going to ride this wave a little bit longer.
Clearly, this cafe is super popular.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. So when would you say, I mean, there's a lot of fear in the market now about various factors being overcrowded, but let's take a little bit more of a historical view. When was the last time people were really worried about factor overcrowding?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting developments in the factor space is kind of using ETFs or index-based factor products. The proliferation of that was very evident back in 2016 when some of the major index fund providers from an ETF perspective were launching single factor indices. So minimum volatility was one of the ones that was under some scrutiny. And with all of the flow that was going into these ETF products, pundits were looking at something like a price to earnings metric of the average stock in a minimum vol or a low volatility index strategy and noticing that it went up. And therefore, if it goes up, it must be overcrowded. The price is gone up. It's more expensive than it used to be, all else equal. So this must be because of the excess flow and demand, and we expect this to crash. So 2016 was when that was being discussed.
So that, I mean, the price to book that you just mentioned, is that one of the red flags that people really look for assessing when a factor might get overcrowded?
Yeah, I think a lot of people look to use, you know, even actually it's kind of using another factor to evaluate a factor like low vol, which is, you know, price to book or price to earnings or some sort of earnings metric. You know, if my earnings are X and my price is going up, obviously it's more expensive than it used to be relative to the earnings that are being produced. So that's kind of an initial screen that people look at to you know, ascertain whether or not a factor might be more expensive today than it was.
Okay, I mean, so but what about you? So let's take the situation now. I mean, what are you looking at beyond price to book? Well, how can we take a more nuanced view? Talk me through some of the complexity of this of factors.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things in financial markets is that you know, there's obviously a behavioral element, and lots of people have different opinions. Mm. So when it comes to just predicting market bubbles, that becomes extremely difficult, as we all know. The timing of predicting bubbles is not something a lot of people have done successfully. And to give you an example of using different metrics to evaluate, you know, the sensitivity of a market to a potential bubble and therefore a crash, some pundits like, you know, price earning as their overarching. This is how I evaluate the stock market. Other pundits use priced earnings growth metric, a PEG ratio. Some use a cyclically adjusted PE. And the interesting thing is all of these metrics tell us different things. It's according to one, markets are undervalued. There's plenty of room for growth. According to another, completely overvalued, it's crash time. And so, you know, I'm always interested to hear, you know, financial experts have such disagreement on something that seems so fundamental. So bring that over into factors, and it's the same story. It's even harder to predict factor bubbles. Academics say there's tremendous depth in the factors themselves. We shouldn't be concerned about short-term price movements. And you know, yes, we can use some of these metrics to give us some detail, but reality, it's also, you know, adding a little bit of another dimension to that in the flow space. So one of the things that you know people were pointing to in 2016 was simply this price has gone up relative to earnings. And there's clearly flow into these products, so therefore they must be overcrowded. It's you know at its peak potentially. What they're not looking at is where that flow is coming from.
Okay.
And who's offsetting this, and who's on the other side of the factor. So for low vol, there's also the other side of the coin, which is high vol. Then you start digging into, you know, some of the detail around why this factor even exists as a risk premia. Generally speaking, you know, one of the thoughts is that, you know, markets go up on average.
Yep.
So active managers are incented to go longer beta stocks, or historically have been incented to go longer beta stocks or higher beta stocks. And that leaves a little bit of room for index managers or other quant active managers to allocate to these lower volatility stocks, which is where some of that premium comes from.
So to take you back a moment to flows, for instance, and I'd like to widen the lens a bit to incorporate that we talked about flows into a certain factor, low volatility. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit more about where the flows into factor-based investing overall are coming from. I mean, we've seen a large piece. In your piece, you have the projected growth of the total assets under management for factors, and it's growing exponentially. I mean, 2016 was high, but it looks like the 2020 projection looks like $1.66 trillion worth. Where is, I mean, do you still believe that this is going to continue? And where is all this money coming from?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So the interesting, if you look at the index versus kind of active market in general, index is about 25% of the total assets under management in the industry, about $14 trillion. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that $1.6 trillion projected in factors, that's a very small portion of the total pie.
Wow.
And so what you'd want to consider is where is this money coming from? And if it's coming from active managers where clients are transitioning to you know, potentially lower cost transparent index funds, you might wonder if they're actually leaving the same exposure that they're going into. Yep. And so really, you know, looking at the price to earnings and some, you know, preliminary flow data is really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to evaluating, you know, where that supply and demand really is when you're looking at that factor specifically.
I mean, would you say that, for the sake of argument, clients invested in a value active manager, and they'll then take a look at the market and say, well, actually, I could possibly get this exposure from a value index fund run by one of the major providers. Are they investing entirely everything into that, or are they more looking at a market cap as well as the value index? Are they still maintaining that single factor exposure, or are they broadening it out to say, I can do a lot more with what I did have in my active value exposure?
Yeah, it's a good question. So actually what we're seeing is still the lion's share of the flow that is left passive for active is going into traditional cap-weighted indexes.
Okay.
So if anything, you might even be net negative on your actual factor allocation when it comes to looking at the market as a whole. And that's hard to ascertain what active managers were in, but assumptions could be made just as well as assumptions could be made on the, you know, the ETF flow that we've seen and people were worried about in 2016.
So that rather dispels the narrative that, you know, factors are, you know, overcrowded, too popular. Everyone's piling into this cafe, because if, as you say, the people who are leaving active are still going into this traditional market cap, that yes, there's more money going into factor-based investing, but it's not all of the money that's leaving active. It's not all of the new money that's coming into factor exposure. It's still market cap is still has the majority of assets, but factors are just becoming a slightly larger part. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in the passive space, you know, clients rely on the low cost, transparent nature of the benchmark, effectively those cap weighted indexes that everyone's accustomed to. So that's definitely where the bulk of the flow has been going. You know, factors are create an opportunity to get some alternatively weighted exposure, which we think is interesting for different market environments. Certainly not a cure-all, but one way to allocate assets. And so, yes, agreed. That's kind of the trend that we're seeing.
So I'd like to move on a bit more to – we've seen where the flows are going. I'd like to move on a bit more to factor performance. And you've got this amazing chart in the piece, and it's super colourful. It breaks each factor, including market cap, into an each colour, and it kind of ranks them every calendar year. And I really would encourage listeners to find it because it's basically Joseph's Technicolor dream coat of a chart. And I look at small cap, and it's kind of – it's top in 2009, 10, 12, 13, 16, but it then bottom in a lot of these off years, and it seems to oscillate very strong. Where do you see the flows going into small cap, and what's kind of, in your opinion, what's created this kind of performance volatility?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one of the things that we do talk about is the cyclical nature of factors, yeah, and when they can be, you know, when they can move in your favor and when they can't. You know, that's the when I say it's not a cure all for the investment industry. Each one of these factors go through significant drawdown, and there's risks associated with investing in them. And so, you know, we encourage investors to look into the detail of what they're getting and when it might perform well, and don't over rely on a back test. But specific to small cap, it tends to be one of the higher volatility factors that you could allocate to.
Yep.
There's a little bit of an unloved thought that they're less covered or less, mm-hmm, you know, interesting than investing in some of the mega cap stocks that you're accustomed to, the Apples, Microsofts, Amazons, and Netflix. And so with that, you know, comes a little potential for a premium, but there's also some risks in that space as well. And so when markets are a little bit more risk off, they're generally the first stocks that are sold, which is why you kind of see that bookending on the quilt chart that we have in there.
Interesting. So I'm sure this is subject for a completely different podcast because we could talk for hours about it. But then I imagine that's why a lot of people kind of diversify across their factor exposure to benefit from that kind of jumping around of the cyclical nature of factors.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you wanted to reduce the longevity and severity of the drawdown associated with the factor, mm-hmm, classic way to do that is a multi-factor strategy that blends multiple together. You know, you're not going to hit the peak that you would in some of these instances. You're going to get more of a smooth return, but it's still pretty potent from an investment standpoint as an alternative to cap-weighted indexing.
To draw this back to at the risk of overextending the cafe analogy, so I'd like to talk about capacity. I mean, how many seats are at this table? How much can this cafe maintain? Capacity seems a very much more quantitative term. The qualitative, the overcrowding is very qualitative, but quantitative is actually how much can a factor contain before it really incurs some problems for investors. So how have you measured this?
Yes, capacity is one of those that definitely has a little bit more rigor when it comes to some of the academic literature that supports capacity calculations. And it's really focused more on a fund allocation. Mm-hmm. How much can I put in this fund, which has these criteria or these factors embedded in it, this kind of rebalance frequency, before I start losing what the fund is saying it's going to do on the 10? And so with that become, you know, you can start looking at things like turnover of the fund, you know, cost of the turnovers of the securities that you're trading within the fund, frequency of rebalances, you know, liquidity of the underlying securities as well. So to give you an example, a very large small cap value fund in the emerging markets would probably face some capacity issues pretty quickly. Doesn't mean that the factors that you're trying to exploit are going away. That's the overcrowding component where that's much deeper. But when it comes down to a fund, especially an index fund, there's a specific point in time when you have to rebalance. There's a specific point in time where you reallocate to factors and stocks. And you know, from an index perspective, you're taking tracking error against a benchmark if you're not doing it on the same day. So that capacity number can be much smaller than I think people view, than people are thinking about the index industry as a whole.
How would people kind of account for this? I mean, I imagine from what you've described, rebalancing, the transaction cost, all of these kind of incur negative effects for investors. And what steps can they take to alleviate a lot of these problems?
Yeah, so specific to the index industry, you know, we recommend significant due diligence when it comes to selecting an index fund. It's not as simple as just thinking that this index, because it says value on it, is going to deliver me just value returns. You know, funny anecdote, there's 15 major U.S. value indexes that exist right now, and the percentage difference between returns over a 10-year period is something in the realm of 50% difference, and they're all supposed to be long-only, you know, value indexes. So, you know, we emphasize you know, significant due diligence into an index methodology, what it's going to do, what the rebalance looks like, how his in-sample and out-of-sample performance looked, and then, you know, ask an index implementer like ourselves to do an analysis on capacity.
Yep.
And that's something that we can do and give you an idea of where this fund might start to lose some of the alpha-generating potential if it were to jump over a certain size.
Are there any kind of last thoughts you'd give to people when considering people who are quite worried about factors at the moment? What's your overall view, taking overcrowding and capacity together? What would be your kind of summarized view?
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of people were a little nervous about the initial inflows into some of these factor strategies, because, you know, this traditionally hasn't been a transparent way of investing money. You know, there's a lot of literature that supports the thesis behind value investing, behind investing in low volatility stocks, but no one has really turned that into a rules-based transparent methodology. And so with that kind of new way of investing comes natural fear that, you know, if I'm seeing some price movement that may be adverse, this is a time to shout overcrowded, or things are at their max limits. But I think, you know, if you look at the time since these factors have been well known, since these indexes have been published, you know, the out of sample results, the actual results that have happened have been very much aligned with what you'd expect from each of the individual factors. So when the market's pulling back, most of the low volatility indexes performed fairly well, which is what you'd expect with more low vol downside kind of protection in an equity portfolio. So that's been shown to be consistent, at least as of now.
I think that's all we've got time for. Dave, thank you so much for being here to help shine a light on the state of factors.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'd like to find out more or just want to see the amazing Technicolor Factor Quilt for yourself, we've linked to Dave's article in the episode notes. Thanks again to everyone listening to this episode of LGIM Talks. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.